Hi, I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Grants.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
Yes.
We have an amazing show. So much to talk about. So much to drink. So, Maya, how are you doing? What are you drinking this week?
All right. I'm switching it up this week, and I made myself a White Russian.
Oh, wow. That's pretty classic.
It's classic, but it's, you know, vodka. I have some very small batch coffee liqueur that I received as a gift at some point. And because I didn't have heavy cream, I used actual, like you know, Mexican, like, crema.
Sure.
You know, like, we had some of it in the fridge. And I'm like, that's like heavy cream. So I did it. I mixed it up. I'm drinking it out of a brandy snifter. And it's great.
I don't know what else you would possibly do with coffee liqueur other than maybe put it in coffee. So I applaud that. I think a White Russian's appropriate. I'm drinking tequila.
Straight?
Yeah.
Are you drinking a sipping tequila? Is that what's going on?
All tequilas can be sipping tequilas if you sip them, Maya. So we have a fun show, as I was saying. We have some listener feedback we're going to respond to regarding the stuff we were talking about in our last episode.
We have listener feedback that goes deep. You guys brought it, and I really appreciate that. Bring it again. We are into it.
We talked about social problem films, and some of our listeners had some thoughts and questions about that topic. So we're going to dive back into that topic a little bit in response to that. Then after that, we want to bring up a new topic, which is some new movies that are coming out by certain directors who have an established body of work. And we know you all want to hear what we think about every work of culture, so you know what to think about it. So we're going to try and stay on top of that. And finally, we have a hot and or weak sauce award. So we should get to it. Oh, wait. Before we do, I have to say one thing. I did watch Inside Man.
Oh!
Yeah.
And?
Last time you recommended it, the Spike Lee joint. It was very enjoyable. I don't think I liked it as much as you did because I had issues with the plot. I found the plot to be unsatisfying.
Okay. You know what? I think that it's that thing, like, we went to see this amazing magician here in LA, Siegfried Tieber. He's like amazing. And there's this way that when I go see a magician, I don't even care how he does it. At a certain point, I just kind of surrender and I'm like, take me there. And I think that that's totally with movies like that. I'm like, I'm not going to look for the holes.
It's not that there were holes per se, just that I found the whole resolution kind of unsatisfying. It didn't really, to me, it was promising a lot in terms of like intrigue and plot twists, and it really didn't deliver much in that regard, but there were amazing performances. Denzel Washington does not age. I loved how New York is a character in the movie, which is true of many of Spike's films, and it was very true here, and it was used to wonderful effect, and he did manage to incorporate all kinds of commentary and themes about the multi-ethnic, multicultural nature of New York and how that comes together and those sort of tensions without making it be this explicit, like, social problem film. Instead, he made a fun bank robbery movie, but it just had those sort of underlying themes in the background.
It's particularly pleasurable because Spike Lee is not a subtle man. No. And he does usually when he approaches those things, it is never with a scalpel. It is with a giant hatchet. And there is something about having to, like, do this Hollywood movie where he had to pull back. And it ended up being 10 times as effective, vibrating, delightful, like, so much more so than when you're like, oh, yeah, I know.
I agree completely. I did enjoy a lot about it. Great performances. Really well directed.
So, listener feedback.
Let's get into some listener feedback. All right. So, first of all, we have at PestoQuiche80s asked us on Twitter, do you think social problem films are less cathartic for the audience when they're documentaries? For example, Blackfish. It's a great question.
It's an awesome question. And I think that what we were saying back is that generally social problem films have catharsis built into their very structure. And documentaries have a lot more room to do more things than just provide catharsis. I mean, there are definitely documentaries that sort of walk that line. But I think documentaries like, for instance, Blackfish, some of them can have a very direct call to action. Stop fucking going to SeaWorld. Like, it's clear what the documentary is asking you to do. And that's not the same as catharsis.
That's true. I was thinking a lot about this because documentaries often are narrative. And the whole reason we were talking about social problem films is because we were talking about the Me Too hashtag and the idea of sharing narratives. And then I had to ask myself, why did we not talk about documentaries, since the narratives being shared on the Me Too hashtag and other similar hashtags are true stories? And we immediately went to fictional stories as a framework for thinking about this. And I think the more I thought about it, the more I was able to sort of make sense of it. Documentaries don't have identification. And I feel like that's the key. In a fiction film, you're going to identify either with the person who's suffering from the social problem or from the white savior or straight savior or whatever figure who's placed in the film for you to identify with as an audience member. And you'd sort of think it's almost counterintuitive because identification should make you care more. But it doesn't turn out to work that way, because the sort of othering of a documentary keeps you as a viewer indicted as part of the problem.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You watch Blackfish and you don't get to leave that feeling like you're some kind of hero because you sympathized with the whale. Sorry, it's terrible. Or with whoever, you know, the noble person fighting for the whales. You leave that feeling like, well, fuck, I've been to SeaWorld a bunch of times and that was me being part of a problem. Or even if you weren't part of the problem, you feel bad for not having known that this problem was going on all this time and you didn't know and you didn't do anything about it.
I also think there's another reason, though, why we are so... First, definitely documentaries can do more things than just create this kind of cathartic... I think some documentaries still create that cathartic moment, but I feel like they can... There's a lot wider, more flexible reach with what a documentary can do to you, can do to the viewer. But I also think there's part of it why we went to the sort of social problem film is also because of what I think we find painful or limiting about the Me Too phenomenon, which is this feeling underneath it that if I just share my story, something's going to change. That fantasy or that dream or that yearning is connected to the narrative of the social problem film, that somehow after this, it is all going to be different. And I think that that's where, even as we're sharing our own stories, even as we are sympathizing and our hearts are broken by these stories because we've also lived these stories, there's something about it that felt limiting. And I think it's because we see it falling into that trap of thinking that it's going to be like a social problem film.
Yeah. And that goes to what you're saying about documentaries being better able to have an explicit and specific call to action. It's hard for a fiction film to do that. And so it's always going to be a little bit more of a muddled message at the end. It's just not going to be as good a fiction film if it ends with somebody saying, and here's what you need to do. Like Gentleman's Agreement, for example, ends with Gregory Peck very clearly saying, here's what people need to do. They need to, when somebody's telling an anti-Semitic joke, you have to stop them. When people are quietly not saying anything as a Jew's being turned away from your country club, you have to step up. That's actually kind of the exception to the rule of social problem films. They usually aren't that totally explicitly didactic. And that's what makes Gentleman's Agreement not a really good film in and of itself. It's very interesting and has a lot to offer, but it's stilted and weird because of that. All right. So I think we agree that social problem films are more cathartic than documentaries, even when they cover the same topics. And that's just sort of the nature of fiction. and how it works.
And it's the nature of the genre of the social problem film.
Yeah.
Because there is a problem that then in some small way or big way gets solved. And I think that's what's painful about this moment. I think Rose McGowan, fucking God bless her. But sometimes when she's like, Rose's army and we're rising and we're going to change things. And I feel like, I don't know if that's really going to happen.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting what you say about how even when things aren't really fixed, by the very nature of Hollywood film narrative structure, there has to be like a climax and resolution. Even if the main character dies and everything turns out shitty, narratively, emotionally, there has to be some kind of climax and resolution that makes you feel like something was accomplished.
And I think that is what people are longing for right now in terms of Me Too. And I don't think we're going to get it, guys.
Sadly, I think it's going to be a lot more work before we get anything like that.
Fuck.
All right. So our other piece of listener feedback is from Guy Branham, who emailed us. He said, Tootsie is the gentleman's agreement of gender. Women's social problem films are always comedies. Private Benjamin, Working Girl, Baby Boom, Just One of the Guys. Women's social problem films cannot be dramas because if they were, men would have to be evil. Tootsie comes closest because he has to accept that he is evil. Also, it would require that we accept that women's situations are bad and that is wrong. Comedies remind us that these problems are manageable.
All right, Guy. I see your Working Girl and Baby Boom, and I'm going to call you on it. Like, you're making very interesting points, particularly about the fact that anything that's come closest to a women's social problem film has to be a comedy. I absolutely...
Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah. Oof, what a point.
Why are all women's social problems or feminist social problem movies comedies?
Because if they were dramas, we would have to be agitating for like a new feminist separatist world. I mean, it would have to be a different world. Like you can have a racial social problem movie because you can say those bad white guys. It's just those specific bad
it's
white
those
guys.
Other white people who are that
and
problem.
It's harder to do that with women's issues because all men are somehow implicated.
Right.
Now, in a racial social problem film, all white people should also be implicated, but people manage to do some very fancy two-stepping around that because it is all white people are completely complicit in a racial system. Come on.
Yeah.
But somehow they're able to make that separation. It's harder when it's about gender.
Yeah, I think it is, especially because, you know, women live with men. We love men. They're so in our lives. And they are part of the system that's causing the problem. So it's a little harder to tease out.
Well, which is why it becomes a comedy.
Right.
It's like, it's why it becomes funny. There's also the thing, the brilliant point that Guy makes, that comedies remind us that these problems are manageable. I feel like there is a way in which the horror of daily sexism, the way that it's this constant drumbeat of, you know, in our lives, I don't know that that is narratively been explored. Yeah. And I think it's because it's really fucking depressing. Like, I don't know that there's a way to, you know, we need to feel like there's a way to fix it.
Thelma and Louise.
There you go.
I'm telling
you. There you go.
Because that film really is like, even the, you know, good male characters or character is really Harvey Keitel's character, but he's trying to do right, but it's the system. He's never going to be able to do enough because the system is already fucking them. And that's why it has to end the way it ends, because there is no solution for them within that system.
Right.
So
right.
I do think that movie comes close in a lot of ways. And interestingly, when that movie came out, a lot of people called it man-hating. And a lot of people complained that all the men in it were villains and all that stuff. So you do run the risk of that happening. A comedy sort of takes a little bit of that, takes the pressure of that away, makes everything laughable a little bit.
Similarly, I mean, that's similar to when the movie The Color Purple came out. And people were pissed that, like, all the male characters are assholes. And it's like, well, yeah, they are. And what's your fucking problem? Because they are all evil.
I didn't know that was a criticism of The Color Purple.
Yeah, that was a big criticism of The Color Purple. There were no good men in
God
it.
God damn it. Harpo's all right. He's just weak.
Yeah. But so even though I think Guy's analysis is fucking brilliant, I have to take exception with some of his examples.
Okay.
Working Girl and Baby Boom. I remember those movies as being like Susan Faludi's examples in backlash of fucking backlash movies against women.
So let's talk about Working Girl first, because that is not a feminist movie. It's like, it's actually a pretty unfeminist movie that is disguising itself as being a women's empowerment movie, but it is so not. So what are some of the issues with Working Girl that we have?
Okay, I think the Sigourney Weaver character, that the big evil like villain has to be a woman.
It's pitting a woman against a woman. Melanie Griffith's character never faces a patriarchal structure that is structured against her. She faces a mean woman, a nasty woman who wants to keep her down. So right there, right off the bat, I mean, it's not that that's like wholly unrealistic. Obviously, in a patriarchal world, there are women who are going to try to keep other women down.
Yes.
But that's not the real problem of patriarchy. So you
right.
can't qualify this as a feminist or social problem movie for that reason. Other issues with Working Girl. This is my big one. Melanie Griffith's character, forgive me, I can't remember any of the characters' names, but ultimately she triumphs by being humble and self-effacing. What happens in the end, if I recall, is that Sigourney Weaver fires her and she sort of humbly leaves and doesn't want to assert herself. And then Harrison Ford's character,
He basically fixes it,
but she does nothing. She does no active agency work to fix the situation for herself. She doesn't even lean in. She does nothing. And it's fixed for her after the climax in the ending where she's now gets her own office and this is her big triumph. She walks into the office and sees a woman with her feet up on the desk, right? And she says to the woman, she assumes that this is her new boss and says, what can I do for you? Or something like that. I don't fucking remember. But then the woman goes, oh, I'm so, so sorry. I just wanted to see what it felt like to be at this desk. I'm your assistant. What can I get you? And to me, that embodies the problem in the movie, which is the reason that we like Melanie Griffith's character and sympathize with her is because she's so humble and self-effacing to the very end. She doesn't even realize she's the boss. She thinks she's the inferior, and that's what's being lauded and congratulated in this movie.
Now,
there is one thing I want to say. The very last shot of that movie kind of sort of slightly redeems it, because she's in her new office and she sits down to enjoy the achievement of now being the boss, and the camera dollies out and then out through the window, and it goes out and out and out, and you see more and more windows in her office building until her window just becomes one of hundreds. And you're like, yes, she is just a anonymous cog in this corporate machine. Congratulations, Melanie.
Let the River Run is a great song, but okay. You know, God love Carly Simon. We love Carly Simon.
Of course.
But okay. Baby Boom. Now Baby Boom, I have to, if I may.
Go ahead.
Fucking Baby Boom is not a women's social, it's not a feminist social problem film. It's maybe a woman's social problem film. And Baby Boom, Diane Keaton is a very successful businesswoman who gets this baby dropped in her lap. And what am I going to do? And it fucks up her job. And so she goes to Vermont and she meets Sam Shepard, rest in peace, who just passed. And he's so fucking cute. And she gives up her corporate life and makes baby food. And the baby completes her.
Yeah.
The baby fucking completes her. While she's a successful businesswoman, I remember Susan Faludi writing about this, because one of the early jokes is that Diane Keaton's living with this man I mean, it's brilliant. Faludi describes it as joyless 4-minute sexual encounters. Like, mm-hmm. she has a sort of live-in boyfriend who she has really shitty sex with. And it's fine because work is the most important thing. But then the baby gets dropped in her lap and it makes her realize work isn't everything. And she should go to Vermont and make high-priced organic baby food.
So I very much appreciate your point. I will give the movie a little bit of credit in that it does explore how having a family becomes impossible for her. She can't have her corporate job and her baby. And it highlights, showcases that as a reality. But you're right. Ultimately, leaving that corporate life turns out to be the better choice for her, because she is a human being now, right? And isn't that funny that she used to be a robot, as working women are, and then she becomes a human being via motherhood.
And oh, you know what? I'm so glad I had babies, Rebecca, because now I am a human being, and I would know. Still be.
That is 100% how I feel about my cats, right? Who would I even be if I were not their mother?
Now, what is interesting, so Working Girl and Baby Boom, they do not get to count because they are not actually dealing with the problem. Private Benjamin, now that is an interesting movie to like take a moment to say hi about Private Benjamin. But Private Benjamin was Nancy Meyer's movie. Yeah. God. And I just feel like now her movies are all like, all I can remember, like reading about her in the New York Times, how she's sitting there being like, the trees look too pointy. I don't want any pointy trees in my kitchen shot. Like, everything is so Vaseline on the lens in her current world. And Private Benjamin was a little rougher. But Tootsie is interesting because, as with Gentleman's Agreement, you can't have an actual woman dealing with the social problem. You can't have a Jew dealing with the social problem. You need somebody standing in for that so that we can identify with him. And Tootsie, there are many things that I love about Tootsie. I love that movie. However, as a social problem movie, God, really? That's all we get?
Yeah. So I wrote a thing about Tootsie for Bitch Flicks a while back. There are a lot of positives you could take from it. It is exploring sexism. It is very explicitly, very clearly, like, he dresses up as a woman to get a job. You know, he has totally selfish reasons for doing it. But in the process of living as a woman and working as a woman, he discovers that people shit on women and it sucks. And so that is clearly depicted. Here's my issue, my biggest issue with it, is the implication that it takes a man to stand up for women's rights. That all these women have been sexually harassed and none of them have known what to do about it. They've just tried to deal with it. But like, all the women on the show realize they can stand up for themselves. Even the woman producer or network exec or whatever learns to stand up to men. And it's like, and a man shall lead them, you know?
Yes.
Only when a man experiences it does he have the wherewithal to say, wait a minute, we don't have to put up with this, and lead the women to their liberation.
That's right. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a white savior, but male savior.
Yes. It's the male savior, and it's also this thing where it's only actually in some ways because of his male entitlement that he's able to like hold the space to say like, this is bullshit, as if women don't try to say this is bullshit
all the time.
And they just get like, oh.
The movie falls short of exploring that, right? Because it's implied there. The reason he's uniquely situated to recognize the problem and speak out about it is because he has male privilege and he's never experienced this before. But the movie falls short of going there and letting you think about how the women have tried to speak up for themselves and have tried to stand up for themselves and how leaning in didn't actually do anything. In fact, what happens is Michael comes in and he's like, well, lean in. And they're all like, oh, shit, what a good idea. And then everything is better, which goes to Guy's point. The problems in social problem films for women and in feminist ones are solved individually. They may be shown to be systemic, but it's always the woman always manages to solve it on her own. So Tootsie has some issues, but it does, in the tradition of social problem films, come very close to being a feminist social problem film.
Closer. It's closer. I thought about it last week. I just couldn't bring myself to like bring it as part of that as we were talking last week, because it is not a woman. It is not a woman. I couldn't do it.
Gregory Peck is not a Jew and doesn't come across as a Jew. And he says several times in the movie, "I, sir, am a Jew," in the least convincing way possible. So there's a tradition there that the movie is following.
That's true. That's true. This week, we've noticed that a certain cohort of directors of our time, young directors of our time, are coming out or have just come out with new movies. And the movies all kind of seem to share a theme. We have Darren Aronofsky, whose movie Mother! Just came out. I know that you have all been waiting for our opinion on that movie. Noah Baumbach just had his Meyerowitz Stories come out on Netflix, with Dustin Hoffman as the old patriarchal artist. And then Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie, The Phantom Thread, is going to be coming out with what is to be Daniel Day-Lewis's final performance in film.
Supposedly.
His last movie, supposedly. And one thing that we noticed is that all of these men who are not actually so much, maybe they're like 10 years older than we are. They're sort of that cohort.
Yeah.
They're all making movies about these troubled male artists. So I think what we're sort of asking is, hey, what's up, guys? Yeah. How you doing?
What's going on?
You guys okay? What's up?
Is it tough? It's hard.
Is this your midlife crisis? Are you all having midlife crises in which you're dealing with being a male artist and the fact that you don't get to be the young male artist anymore? Hey, guys, what's up?
It sucks, right? Getting a little older.
A little long in the tooth.
You know, realizing maybe that your genius has not blossomed the way you expected it would. I don't know.
And maybe it's the fault of women. I think in all of these movies, what's very interesting. So Mother is about, you know, the man and the woman who he creates. And it's very much Darren Aronofsky being this like, I'm going to tell this narrative story in this very poetic way. It's going to be in everybody's talk. It's so weird. It's so crazy. It's so mind blowing.
It's allegorical.
It's allegorical. Okay, so we
it
have this
all
allegory.
It symbolizes stuff. It symbolizes something.
It does. So we have man, writer man, makes...
His name is actually him.
Him. He makes Mother...
he takes like a crystal thing and places it on...
A pedestal.
A pedestal. Thank you.
He literally puts something on a pedestal.
He puts the crystal thing on the pedestal and it causes Mother to generate, to exist. And how do you even describe what's going on in this movie?
Part of what makes it so brilliant, Rebecca.
Yeah. There's some ongoing disagreement between him and Mother.
There's some weird guests who show up.
Yes.
There's a
couple who show up, man and the woman show up, and the man has an injury in the rib area. It's, I don't know, it means something, because I can't quite parse it. So, and then there's some sons. Oh, yeah, there's two boys. I'm not getting the analogy. I'm not getting it.
And they fight, and the oldest son kills the younger son.
Yeah, nothing. I'm not getting anything out of that. Yes. So him, the Javier Bardem character, is your male artist, right? He's a writer. He's literally a writer. And he impregnates Mother. And then the baby is murdered by the public. What does it mean, Maya? I can't. I can't. So,
and mother destroys the people who killed her baby, but in the process of doing so, she is horrifically burned while him is completely unscathed.
But he, spoiler alert, pulls out her heart, which then he uses to start the cycle again and generate a new mother. Now it's so deep. It's so deep. So, okay, I'm not the biggest fan of Aronofsky's work generally. I'm going to just start with that. I found Requiem for a Dream to be problematic, largely because it's basically a very slickly directed after-school special. It's about don't do drugs.
Yeah.
And layered on top of that really trite messaging is this whole plot line where the younger woman character is, she falls into sex work. And this is depicted as this terrible outcome. Kids, don't do drugs because you're going to wind up doing ass to ass. And nothing could be worse than that. And also there's like specifically a scene where she gives a blowjob to the black drug dealer in exchange for drugs. And I find that to be a trope that I've seen in at least a couple different movies I can name. Pretty white girl gets into drugs and you know it's bad because she has sex with a black guy.
Real
problematic there. So
yeah, that's bad.
That movie did not win me very strongly. But I do notice this. Aronofsky has a long-standing fascination with this theme of the artist, the tortured artist.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what The Wrestler was about, very much.
Very much so.
And it's certainly what Black Swan is about.
Yes.
Which is a woman artist. It's a longstanding fascination of his. It's not just that he's coming to it now. He's been exploring this theme. I like Black Swan, but not for any of the reasons you're supposed to like it, I think. I think I like it for my own particular reasons. It's a pretty silly movie.
And I feel like Mother is his... It's like anything that he was trying to do in terms of story, he's like, I'm just going to make it this allegory. I'm going to take away all the story and then it'll be very pure in its allegory. And I destroy Mother so that
the
I may...
The mother who incubates my creative seed.
Yes.
Right? It's very much... Like, I guess maybe he thinks he's being critical of this setup, of this artist, muse, man, woman setup. But it's so tiresome, this idea of the woman existing as vessel, literally as vessel for the man's creative output.
All right. So we have Mother. Then we have Noah Baumbach, who's all about dysfunctional New York families. Okay. And now he has his latest dysfunctional New York family, Meyerowitz stories. Mm-hmm. We have Dustin Hoffman. He's an artist. He wasn't as successful as he wanted to be. He has three fucked up kids. They're all fucked up. And it's kind of funny. And we have Adam Sandler being a serious actor as the son. And it's kind of funny, but they're living in the shadow of their father, who then we realize wasn't even that successful, and we're supposed to feel really like bad for, and I cannot bear it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I am looking at his IMDb, and I am kind of proud to say I've never seen any of Noah Baumbach's movies. I mean, I've seen some stuff that he's written, I guess, but not that he's directed.
Because he wrote a lot of the scripts for Wes Anderson, who we were having disagreements about earlier today.
We disagree a little bit on Wes Anderson.
Just a little bit.
Let's circle back to Wes Anderson after we talk about the other Anderson.
The other Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson, whose movie is also about the tortured male artist and his relationship with women. The Phantom Thread.
Yeah, The Phantom Thread. It's specifically about a middle-aged man. In this case, he's a dressmaker. And his relationship with a much younger woman who is his muse, but causes him some drama.
And you know what the problem is that he takes this woman, he plucks her from out of nowhere and makes her his muse. And then she starts having opinions.
Right. She wants to be her own person. Can
God, she
that?
Wants to be her own person, but she's not the genius. He's the genius. How dare she?
Right? Like, okay, so I fucking hate this theme. Can you hear me clapping? I fucking hate this theme. Stop, men, making movies about tortured male geniuses and how they have to be assholes to women. I know. I get it. I get that P.T. Anderson is not saying it's a good thing. He's saying it's all in the trailer. Go fucking look up the trailer and watch it. It's all he fucks up every relationship. He creates unnecessary drama. She's just trying to love him, but he's not going to allow that to happen. But ultimately, what you're going to understand is that that's what he needs for his genius. That, yes, he's self-sabotaging and he is destroying her life and it's not cool, but that's art, man. That's art.
And he's the genie and he's the genius, and that's the most important thing to understand.
Right.
Is that in no way, even as this muse, she might have like a couple of ideas, but like she is absolutely not the genius. And first of all, we have to be like, hey guys, what's up? Mm-hmm. So you're all turning 50 and you're having some problems. And we hear that. We see that. Okay. You're like, you're having a midlife crisis. We get you. We get it. But the thing that it made me think about is a movie from this little omnibus film that happened in the 80s called New York Stories, where Scorsese, Coppola, and Woody Allen each do this sort of short film. And it's this collection of three short films. And the best one in terms of film qua film, but the one that is the craziest making, is Life Lessons by Scorsese, which is essentially about Nick Nolte as this painter. He has his girlfriend, played by Rosanna Arquette, and they have this tortured relationship where she's incredibly bitter about having to be his assistant. They are no longer together. And in the climax, she demands him to tell her, is she talented? And he says, no, you're not. She leaves, and the film ends with a new woman who's going to be his muse assistant before he gets rid of her. And we are left supposed to feel like this woman is awful because she's not the genius. She has to accept that she is not the genius and he is.
To me, the whole theme of that, the ultimate arc of life lessons is not her arc. It's his arc. He needs to feed off the drama created by the conflict with her. He basically has to torture her so that he can create his own art. And the more their relationship gets rocky and the more they fight, the more tense the relationship gets, the more he's able to make art. And then when he's done with this round of work and he's ready to have his opening, he's done with her. And
yes,
he's ready to take on a new assistant who will become his lover. And then they will have this torrid, conflict-filled affair that will fuel his next round of creativity.
Yes.
And it's so explicitly, like, it's just so obviously Martin Scorsese being like, yes, I'm an asshole, but I'm a genius. And I have to be an asshole to be a genius.
And what's interesting in my experience is that this movie was mostly beloved and recommended to me by a male director who tried to do that to me, mm-hmm. where he was supposed to be my mentor, but really I was supposed to be his muse. And he loved that movie. For him, it was like a roadmap for living.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's problematic.
yes, it is.
Oh, my God.
Especially because I think what's the most interesting about it is the treatment of the female character's own ambition
yeah.
as something that's so laughable, that's so minor. And that her resentment of him is just when she becomes disposable. And what's interesting about the person who had me watch this movie is that he would always, didn't matter what age he was, he always dated women who were in their early 20s. And this is for years after we broke up. They would always break up with him at around 27 when they're like, wait a second, I want to have a life.
Yeah.
And that was always the moment where the relationship would end. But there's a way in which the story is framed that her own ambitions, like, duh, she's not as talented as him. Like, of course she's not. She is just there as an appendage and she has to face that pain. And I think that that's something we see in a lot of these men's movies, that even the smart, brilliant women, ultimately, they don't have a story.
Right, right. So one director that I think follows in this tradition to a T is Tim Burton. Now, I love Tim Burton. I do. But I have to admit, 9 out of 10 of his films are about a gothic tortured genius who hurts the people around him, but he has to for his art.
Yes.
Like, that's Edward Scissorhands. like it's so much Edward Scissorhands. It's like, have you ever seen such an autobiographical movie as Edward Scissorhands?
No,
it's
like, I know. The hair.
He has a cookie for a heart, you know? And he just wants to create shrubbery art, but he can't help it. The thing that makes him able to create the shrubbery art is the scissor hands, which is the very thing that hurts the people around him. It's like so literal. God, I love that movie. And I cry at the end of that movie every time I watch it. I'm sorry. It doesn't matter. The thing is, he has a sense of humor. Burton manages to have a sense of whimsy, and it's less self-indulgent coming from him. You have to look at it for a minute to see how self-indulgent it is. It's not on the surface so obvious.
Right. And it's not that he's the only one. We made a list in like 2 seconds. We have like... Walk the Line is the tortured, you know, Johnny Cash. He needs to be supported. You need to support the tortured artist. We have Shine, Pollock, Beautiful Mind,
Steve Jobs,
Social Network.
So many of these are true stories. So there's a thread there of the true story biography of a man has to fit this tortured genius mold where you have to show what an asshole he is to all the people around him, but that almost makes him better because he's better than everyone. Like in The Social Network, yes, there's no question that he's supposed to be an unappealing character. You're supposed to, you know, cluck your tongue at his unattractive qualities, but also he wins.
Yes.
He wins at everything. And yes. The whole motivation there is that he's chasing tail, basically.
Yeah.
He can't go to the parties with the hot chick, so he starts Facebook. Can we talk about best movie, Birdman?
Oh, God.
The Iñárritu movie.
God.
Yeah.
That's a movie. And, you know, one of the things with all these movies, with all of the, because I live in L.A. I know a lot of, like, men who work in the industry. Good guys. They're good guys. They're like dads at my kids' preschool. They're good. And they're always loving these movies because they're visually luscious. They're well directed. Like, this is a whole world that they are absorbed in.
Sure.
They all loved Birdman. They loved Birdman. And when I tell them, like, I fuck that movie.
I know.
Fuck that movie. And I love Michael Keaton, but fuck that movie.
Yeah. I had hope that maybe it would go somewhere interesting because it's trying to explore this question about art. I liked the idea of the contrast of the movie star trying to legitimize himself as an artist, right? He had only done Batman movies, right? Birdman movies.
Right.
And he wants to prove that he's a legitimate artist versus the stage actor played by Edward Norton, who believes that he is the real artistic genius, the authentic artist. So there's the potential to explore lots of interesting questions about authenticity and art. And commercialism in art, it didn't quite live up to what I'd hoped in that regard. It really did sort of boil down to a midlife crisis.
But also, I feel like the ways in which the women are portrayed.
Oh, of course.
And the sort of like, there was nothing enlightening or interesting about them. There's the like smart daughter. It's like the second that the smart, sassy daughter actually, the second that any woman gets wise or gets hip to anything, she just becomes the uninteresting, sexless wife. Like, that's the crossover. Like, before, she's still kind of sexy and kind of, she can be a little kicky. There's that character in every Woody Allen movie, that smart young thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was that smart young thing.
Right.
But then the second that she's like, oh, wait, I'm not going to put up with your shit anymore.
Right.
She sort of crosses. She's no longer in any movie. That character isn't there.
No fun anymore. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-mm.
I also want to bring up Mad Men, the TV show.
Oh, yeah.
Which, first of all, straight off the bat, I fucking love Mad Men. I think it is the best TV show of all time, period. Don't at me. It's fine. We're done. That's the end of that conversation. But that said, I could definitely categorize it as falling into this mold. I would give Mad Men credit that the female characters are beautifully developed. Full credit to the writers of Mad Men and to Matt Wiener, the showrunner, for creating amazing female characters and a very nuanced and complex world with a lot of depth. But it is still about a male genius who is a complete asshole to the people around him. The only reason anyone would ever forgive Don Draper for the shit he does is because of his genius.
That's right.
Because
yes.
He came up with It's Toasted.
Right. The show gets away with a lot because of Peggy.
Yes.
Because there was definitely a period there where Don Draper is just going through these women. Like, at a certain point, they were running through all the women in Don Draper's life, and you're like, oh yeah, there was that brunette. Like, there's definitely a period where there are these weird, tortured side relationships. And I feel like Peggy's ascent is what saves it.
I agree in part, but I also think that Joan's journey also saves it.
Oh, that too.
And
yes, absolutely.
Even Betty's journey.
Yes.
The women go through their own journeys. They are not just foils. They're not just there to do something for Don. And in fact, a huge theme of the show is working through the way Don does treat women like that. The way he treats them like they're there to do something for him. And there's some kind of like stepping stones on some kind of journey he's on. If you haven't watched all the seasons of Mad Men, this is one I'm not going to spoil because you have to fucking see it. But there's a lot of exploration through flashbacks of his history and understanding how he came to his feelings about women.
Yes.
It's a fantastic show. But it takes, I'll give it credit now that I'm putting it in these terms, I'm realizing it takes that very theme from Life Lessons, but actually explores it in a way that doesn't either glorify it so that your asshole artist friend can model his life after it.
Right.
Or if you're going to be generous, condemn it and be like, this is so bad. It's so bad that us male artists are like this. It's like the simplistic, either it's great or it's bad, but inevitable because we're artists and we're geniuses.
Right. Right.
Mad Men doesn't fall into that trap. Mad Men is like, this is a broken person and we're going to explore the real effect it has on the people around him.
It's a broken person. We're going to explore that. But also, it's a broken person in a time.
Yes.
This is a time. And it said it is bounded by time. And it doesn't have that feeling of like, this is a timeless quality. I think a huge part of Mad Men is it's trying to say this guy's day is ending. This is a new world. Like, there is a new world that's coming. And I think what we're trying to get to in this moment where we're talking about these movies that are all coming out with these male geniuses, the sort of cohort of white male directors that I feel like I came up with in my 20s and 30s,
mm-hmm.
Is it a new time? Is it a new time? Why are we still seeing these movies? Like, why am I supposed to go watch an exquisitely shot, gorgeously filmed movie about Daniel Day-Lewis mm-hmm. having life lessons with dresses? Why? why is this supposed to be fresh? Why is this the event of the year? Why is Mother, which is like this allegory of like male genius, and oh, guess what? The woman gets destroyed and replaced. What is going on? And I think that it's very interesting that all these movies are being released as we are dealing with this fallout of male genius over Hollywood right now. A lot of male geniuses are getting their shit called out this week.
Not enough.
Well, one that I have really enjoyed is watching James Toback go down.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy, so James Toback, he's a director. You probably haven't heard of him because I think he's made sexual harassment his full-time job. He directed Fingers. He directed Black and White. He directed Two Girls and a Guy. He did a lot of movies and he had his whole thing going. He had a whole thing. And basically he, in the LA Times, they wrote an article about him. 38 women have said that he has harassed them. He had a whole shtick where he would stop them on the street, say, you are going to be my muse. You're going to be my new star for my film. Come meet me. And then he would try to have some kind of sexual encounter with them. So this is what he did. And in the 24 hours since the LA Times released this article, the author has received 193 more women.
Oh, wait. 193.
In addition to the 38 that were in the article.
Coming forward to add accusations.
Like, this happened to me, too. This happened to me, too. Like, yeah, amazing. James Toback, totally. This is what he did full time. But here's what's even more amazing. Spy Magazine in 1989. A woman had gone through this experience with him and she wrote for Spy Magazine and they wrote this amazing 6-page spread where she found 13 other women who went through this experience and they made a whole chart of the entire process by which he approaches each of these women.
Wow.
And how sort of gross it gets. And then they told him they were writing this article and he's like, I'll take a polygraph test. So they're like, sure. And then he doesn't show up for the polygraph test.
Oh my God.
He threatens them. He's like, this will be the worst thing that you ever do. You will regret this for the rest of your life. They publicly humiliated him. They couldn't have, it was like so awesome. And yet, even with this public humiliation of what a disgusting sleaze he was, even in this way where it was so obvious that this was his pattern of behavior, this was in 1989, and he was still doing that 10 years later when I heard about him doing this to actors I knew, and even another 20 years after that.
Because 13 doesn't meet the threshold. You have to have somewhere between 30 and 100 and what? 150?
193 plus 38. Like, this is over that's 200
the,
women.
That meets the threshold. No one's going to believe 13 women, Maya. You got to get into triple digits before anyone's going to listen.
That or before it makes a difference. Everybody knew that he did this and it's not like his career was going so well. Mm-hmm. But this was his performance and it worked.
So how is this connected to what we've been talking about with these films that are coming out and this theme of the tortured genius and the way he relates to the women in his life?
I feel like this character mm-hmm. of the male genius and this role that the woman is supposed to have in that interaction mm-hmm. is part of what we're looking at here.
Yeah.
She's a vessel. She is there to be admired. She's there to be used. She's there to be at his service.
Yes.
And I think that we're seeing that still in these men who, like, they grew up in the 70s and 80s. Like, weren't we past this? They were kids when Tootsie happened. Why are we telling these stories? Why are the big male artists of this moment, of this cohort of men, writing these same stories? Can't they do something more interesting?
But look at the biographical movies that you mentioned. This is a narrative in our culture. And we think it's real. It's not just a fictional narrative, although we've come up with several examples of fictional versions.
Right.
Our culture believes it to be a truth. that
yes.
that this is the nature of genius. That first of all, genius is male.
And yes.
that second of all, genius is tortured. Artistic genius particularly, but any form.
Yes.
The artist has to have inner pain, and he has to cause pain around him because he's never going to be properly understood.
Yes.
And women exist. It's a really interesting dynamic because women exist to serve several functions, right? First of all, they're muses, they're inspiration.
Yes.
They're there to inspire the genius, but they're also there to be the source of the conflict and drama that's going to fuel the artist. And then they're also there to just be hurt by the artist's inevitable hurting people around him.
Yes.
Because that's what we figure as being the nature of artisticness, of creativity, is that it somehow, by its very nature, requires hurting people.
Yes, but it requires hurting people because in order to be a visionary, you have to be outside of those rules.
Yes, exactly.
Like you have to be outside the rules of culture, which is very much a surrealist move. We're going to like expose the hypocrisies of middle-class bourgeois life by being so outside of it, which I'm very much in sympathy of. It's not like I think that's completely wrong. I definitely think that the artist is there to sort of hold a space where they're saying, oh, maybe you want to question the rules that you live by all the time.
Right.
But that's not what this is.
It conflates the rules of society and essential like respect for other people. As
yes.
if flouting the rules of society also means not being nice to people. And you're just going to reject this requirement that you treat other people like they're human beings.
Well, but it also has this nice essentializing around it.
Yes.
There's this man whose essential job is to like push and fight in this way. And there are these women whose essential job is to be the mother.
Right.
Because that's what women are good at. We're good at sort of being appealing by being sexy. Mm-hmm. And we're good at helping and adjusting and assisting and
but
facilitating.
Then eventually, we become more of a problem than we're worth.
That's because eventually we get sick of it.
Right.
And
then they get sick of us.
Yeah.
It's a problem for artists.
Oh, God. Well, all I can say is we actually haven't seen any of those movies. I think it's really important for us to share. We did not see Mother. I'm not going to watch the Meyerowitz stories. And as much as I love to watch Daniel Day-Lewis chew the furniture, I will watch him do that shit all day. I'm not fucking seeing The Phantom Thread. I'm sorry.
No.
Nobody can tell me that P.T. Anderson's approach is somehow surprising. I don't buy it. All right, guys. Hot sauce. Michael Bay is doing a live action Dora the Explorer movie.
That is a real sentence. That is true. Like, what do you do with that? Where do you take that? I'm not even sure we should give it the hot sauce or the weak sauce. Like, we need another sauce for this. This is a third kind of sauce, but I haven't quite figured out what. So yeah, Michael Bay is going to make a Dora the Explorer live action movie with Dora as a teenager. And I am 100% going to go see it. There is no question. So I've been wondering about how he should cast it. I don't care. Dora can be whoever. All I care is he has to cast a Latina. If he casts a fucking white girl, oh my God. But what I really want to know is who's going to play Swiper the Fox. Who's going to play Swiper? I want to see Ethan Hawke as Swiper. Now, I assume Boots is going to be a CGI monkey. I can't really see them putting a person
Boots. But maybe they'll have Andy Serkis.
Oh, my God. Do the motion capture for Boots. Yes, that's perfect. So Andy Serkis will be Boots. He'll do the mocap and the voice. And we need a good Swiper.
Oh, my God.
I am 100% behind this.
Michael Bay, Dora the Explorer. I'm just hoping that he's not going to use the auditions for this movie as a chance to have sex with a lot of underage Latino women.
Things? Why you got to ruin everything?
Well, no, why do I have to ruin things? Why are they ruining things? It's not my fault.
Women who talk about men's bad behavior are ruining everything.
It's true.
But on a positive note, it will be a major action movie with a Latina lead, right? That's good.
You know what? We're Michael Bay, Dora the Explorer. Wow.
Yeah, it's some kind of sauce.
Some kind of sauce. We don't know.
As yet to be determined. So we want to hear from you if you have a thought on what the third sauce is, or thoughts on white male directors and their midlife crises, or even more thoughts about social problem films, or any topic that you might like to hear us talk about.
If James Toback sexually harassed and assaulted you, we want to hear that story.
Sure. Bring it. Look, if you want to make it all public, we're probably not the outlet that's going to reach the most people, but it's a start. Yeah, we're here for you. We support you.
We are.
So you can reach us in many ways on email. We are saucepodcast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter @saucepodcast. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm @gynostar. Maya, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at mayagarantz.com. You can find my website where all my weird, freaky art stuff is. You know, and hey, if Noah Baumbach, if you're listening, Darren, PT, what's up, guys?
Yeah, what's
How you
what's
doing?
Up, guys?
Do we need to have a therapy circle? Do we need to have a group therapy session where we talk about, like, what's going on? We'll talk about it with you.
We'll
we're here to help
it.
You.
Yeah, I mean, we're women. We're women. That's what we're here for.
We're here to facilitate your genius, guys.
All right, until next week, have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.